Coming up, Ransom, Taken. Movie battle begins now.
Welcome to Movie Battle. Each episode, superfans battle it out to see which film is best. Here's your host, Kevin Armstrong.
What is up, party people? Welcome to Movie Battle. I am your host, Kevin Armstrong. This is episode 12, Ransom versus Taken. This is a classic battle of what parents will do to protect their children. Don't mess with anyone's child. That will get even the most God-fearing man or woman to stop and say, oh, hell no. We're going to bring the superfans out in a few, but first, here are some facts and tidbits. Ransom is directed by Ron Howard. The screenplay is by Richard Price and Alexander Ignan, based on the story by Cyril Hume and Richard Maybaum. Ransom stars Mel Gibson, Rene Russo, Gary Sinise, Delroy Lindo, Lily Taylor, Evan Handler, Donnie Wahlberg, Dan Hedaya, and Liev Schreiber. Ransom was released November 8, 1996. It had a budget of $70 million and grossed a box office of $309.5 million. Ransom has a Rotten Tomatoes score of 75%. Taken is directed by Pierre Morel. It is written by Luc Besson and Robert Mark Kamen and stars Liam Neeson, Maggie Grace, Leland Orser, John Grease, David Warshawski, Katie Cassidy, Holly Valeri, and Famke Janssen. Taken was released January 30th, 2009. It had a budget of $25 million and grossed a box office of $226.8 million. Taken has a Rotten Tomatoes score of 58%. While filming Ransom, Mel Gibson suffered from appendicitis and had to have it operated on. He was able to overcome this and earn a Golden Globe nomination for Best Actor, Motion Picture Drama. The original version of Ransom was an episode of the 1950s show The United States Steel Hour titled Fearful Decision. Richard Maybaum and Cyril Hume adopted into the 1956 feature film Ransom, starring Glenn Ford, Donna Reed, and Leslie Nielsen. The film was also influenced by Ed McBain's novel, King's Ransom. Taken was released during the Super Bowl weekend in 2009 and set the record for best opening day ever during Super Bowl weekend. It had the second highest Super Bowl opening weekend at the time, behind only Hannah Montana and Miley Cyrus' Best of Both Worlds concert. Taken has two sequels, Taken 2, released October 3rd, 2012, and Taken 3, released December 16th, 2014. Taken, the TV series, ran on NBC for two seasons from 2017 to 2018. In season 39, episode 15 of Saturday Night Live, Liam Neeson reprised the role of Brian Mills. In the show's opening sketch, he responds to Vladimir Putin's invasion of Ukraine in defense of President Obama. There you have it. We will be right back with the superfans after this. Welcome back to Movie Battle. Our first guest is making his debut appearance. Adam Lippe from New York City, went to Emerson College. He is the writer, producer, and director of the viral pandemic horror comedy, Wait, Wait, Don't Kill Me, which was released on August 21st, 2020, and can currently be streamed online. Adam currently lives 35 miles outside of Philadelphia with his female partner and their dog. Adam, welcome to Movie Battle.
Thank you very much, Kevin.
Adam, how would your parents describe what you do for a living?
Well, my main job involves doing very dull paperwork for a construction company, but primarily they might think of me as a writer, producer, director of the aforementioned horror comedy.
That's great. Adam, who plays you in a movie about your life?
Well, when I was younger, I looked a lot like Josh Charles from Sports Night and Threesome.
Yeah.
And occasionally I get confused for Noah Wiley when I was younger. I do not look like either of them anymore. But I do have a script that I've written that is based on some events in my life. And so whoever ends up playing me in that at various ages will probably be the closest approximation. Although I have a thing, and when I write something that's reflective of who I am, I like to take any reason that anyone might like me and throw it out and make the person as unlikable as possible.
That is interesting. Why would you go that route?
I think it is a challenge. One of my biggest influences, besides David Mamet, is Neil LaBute. And his material, especially his early material, so misanthropic, and is kind of daring you to dislike everybody and still sit through the comedy and the darkness and not be not shudder or turn away from it. And I think of that as an interesting challenge.
Adam, that's amazing. That would be remarkable. I hope you can write that and get that produced. I think our audience and everyone would like to see that.
Well, I mean, I would probably just make it myself. You know, sometimes you write scripts where you know no one else will make it. And in an industry in which there are no helping hands unless you know someone who knows someone, if you can make it small and make it yourself, you might as well do it. So that's, I just think, okay, as long as you keep the budget low, shoot it quickly, you know, shoot it like a play, which, wait, Don't Kill Me, the movie that I'm, that's out right now, is not remotely a play, but I want to shoot things that are a lot smaller in the future. So this would be one of those things.
That's great advice for any aspiring filmmakers out there. Adam, what is your go-to movie snack?
When in a movie theater, which I do not recommend at the moment, don't do it to yourself. Don't take a risk. It would be nachos with cheese and jalapeno peppers. Although I am gluten intolerant, so the cheese can be iffy depending on where you get it. But that's what I used to eat all the time when I was younger in the theater.
Yeah, that's an all-time movie battle favorite. We love our nachos. We even had a nachos versus wings battle not too long ago. And, well, as far as I'm concerned, nachos won, but...
Well, I mean, it would depend on the kind of wing and the kind and how you're making it. I mean, I make wings where you make a sauce before the you actually cook the wings. So you melt butter and you put hot sauce in the butter and you make a sauce, and then you pour that over the wings while they're still cold, and then you cook the wings and you flip them. And that seems to improve the results, I find, if you're going to make them yourself anyway.
Absolutely. That's an interesting technique. I might have to try that.
Depending on your hot sauce, depending on the level of vinegar. I wouldn't do it with Tabasco. It's a little too thick.
I'll have to remember that.
Something a little thinner, not so strong, like Frank's Red Hot. There's the viral marketing for Frank's Red Hot. You can bleep that if it's...
No. Frank's is a good trap. I'm pretty sure there's some Frank's in my fridge right now.
But anything that's a little, that's not so strong, like anything that you see on hot ones is too much to do it that way. But something that's sort of like low level to mid level hot sauce will work in that fashion.
Okay. Well, that was Wingtips with Adam here on Movie Battle. Adam, back to the movie battle. You are a Ransom super fan. What is it you love so much about the film?
Well, I'm going to say that I appreciate the film for what it's trying to do. But I think the theatrical cut is kind of middling. But there's an extended cut on Laserdisc that for some reason is not on Blu-ray or DVD that is really quite good and is about 20 minutes longer. You can find the deleted scenes on YouTube, but it really works much better with the scenes integrated into the film. It adds a lot more character. As I said, you can find the extended scenes on YouTube, but if you got yourself a Laserdisc player, you can probably find the disc on eBay for a couple bucks. It's totally worth it. So with the theatrical cut, it's a perfectly respectable genre movie, you know, good twists and turns and good writing by Richard Price, who wrote, for The Wire and wrote Clockers and Freedom Land. And they, you know, they exceed the minimum expectations you have in a kidnapping slash abduction thriller, but the longer cut, the extended Laserdisc cut, the characters are much, much messier, and it's a much better movie for it, because you learn in that cut that Mel Gibson did bribe the Dan Hedaya character and approached him first, as opposed to in the theatrical cut where they don't have any of that stuff. He admits it to Delroy Lindo, who tells Mel Gibson that their conversation is not protected by any sort of confidentiality. And Delroy Lindo's part's much bigger in the extended cut, and he's the best part of the film. You learn that Rene Russo's character had four miscarriages before she had their son, which of course makes it more precious. She doesn't get any backstory at all in the theatrical. She's just kind of the, you know, the harried wife. But when you understand that, then you start to get, oh, right, okay, so this is the, this was her, their sort of miracle child. You'll see they cross cut between the anxious parents missing their children, missing their child, and Gary Sinise and Lily Taylor being in bed anxiously dealing with like what they think might happen. And you don't have any of that in the theatrical. They just kind of simplify everything, and it's kind of a bummer that they do that. As I said, you see Adore Lindo a lot more than you do in the theatrical cut, including that his boss tells him that he's got to rein in Mel Gibson's excessive behavior, and it lends credence to some scenes that happen later where he kind of tells Rene Russo that Mel Gibson did commit the crime in bribing Dan Hedaya. And what that brings to mind is, oh, well, that explains why he did that, because his boss was on him to do that. And if you without those scenes, it seems kind of random and arbitrary and just kind of like mean-spirited to do that and manipulative. So when he does turn Rene Russo against Mel Gibson in order to convince her to try to maybe pay the ransom, it makes a little bit more sense. I don't know how much you want me to get into. Like the extended cut is so different, even though it's only 20 minutes. That's a lot of material. I don't know how much you want, because I'll go on.
Adam, you are coming correct. Just keep bringing it, you know.
Okay, well, so in the extended cut, there's some really good work between with Mel Gibson and Rene Russo, where they have to take a lie detector test. And then again, that's not a theatrical cut, and they do that. And then in the midst of the lie detector test, Mel Gibson's the test, he starts to go nuts. Like he's clearly lying about something when they ask him if he had anything to do with his child's kidnapping. And that's why he reveals to Delroy Lindo that he, in fact, did do the bribe. And it makes, again, the character messier, and it explains why they start talking about that, which isn't evident at all in the theatrical cut. It seems kind of random. Because Mel Gibson thinks that his he that thinks that perhaps that the kidnapping has to do with the bribe, which then sets up the scene with Dan Hedaya. Now, one of the interesting things about the casting of Dan Hedaya is originally he's only in one scene in the movie, but when you see that name in the credits, you think, oh, he's going to be the slimy bad guy, and you think like, oh, I see where this is going. But what's interesting is they actually cast all these kind of classically trained actors as all the villains. So you have Gary Sinise and Lily Taylor and Liev Schreiber and Evan Handler, and like it's the complete opposite of what you expect, because you cast Dan Hedaya, you're thinking sort of like commando slimy Dan Hedaya, and then he just shows up one scene, acts like a maniac, and then never comes back. And what's funny is originally they cut the scene, and he what that scene wasn't going to be in the movie, but they put it back because it helped the audience understand the motivation and for Mel Gibson. But just when you see his credits, his name in the credits, you think he's going to have a bigger role, and you think the movie's going to be more traditional than it really is. So it's actually an interesting kind of misdirect, just like the lie detector thing is a misdirect, because obviously Mel Gibson's not really involved in the kidnapping. So there's another extended scene that I really like, where Mel Gibson goes outside trying to think of what to say to the media, and they're all standing outside his apartment building, and where he lives in the penthouse, and he just keeps opening his mouth. He's about to say something, and he doesn't say something. And he's about to say something, he doesn't say something. And we see also Gary Sinise reacting to this later, and that making Gary Sinise very nervous about what's going to happen. But we don't. All of that stuff is cut from the theatrical cut, so you don't see that a part of this is Mel Gibson doesn't know what to say, and he does regain control later, and it makes sense when he does everything on his own terms. When the reporters are shoving microphones in his face, he doesn't know what to do because he's at their mercy. But when he's in control and he's at his mercy, that really helps. And it kind of brings up a thing that Mel Gibson himself is obsessed with, which is he loathes the press, he loathes the paparazzi. He produced a movie called Paparazzi, in which he has a cameo, which was that movie was directed by his hairdresser. And am I exaggerating? That was literally his hairdresser. So all of this sort of messiness is a huge improvement on what could be a fairly boilerplate thriller. And all these, extra scenes really, I think, are a boon to the movie. And it's more obvious when you compare it to the 1956 version. Now, this movie is the 1996 Ron Howard version, is a remake, but not necessarily the 1956 version. But there was a 1953 version that was on television on the United States Steel Hour with Ralph Bellamy, and he was nominated for an Emmy. It's also kind of based on an Ed McBain novel and the Kurosawa film High and Low, but it's mostly very similar to the 1953 and 1956 version. And the 1956 version, there is no messiness at all. The guy is just straight laced. The wife is drugged up from the beginning. You don't even hear anything of her at all. She's literally like they bring in. She's played by Donna Reed. They bring in a nurse who drugs her up, and then that's pretty much, you know, her contribution. You never even see the villains. You don't hear them at all. It's just this man who is straight laced, who has never done anything wrong, and you know, at the end of the movie, the kid comes back, and there's no explanation as to why he came back, except maybe they were scared or something. And it's very religious. It's very straight laced. There's lots of Bible quotes. It's wildly unsatisfying because, you know, it's a lot of it's inexplicable. Other than the scene that's repeated where he's threatening the kidnappers, there aren't that many similarities. And it's amazing how much of an improvement the 1996 version is because of its messiness, because it's not just this, you know, this is a good guy and he's going to, you know, rescue his son. What I think it helps the movie, interestingly, is all of Mel Gibson's legal problems have improved the movie in the strangest way in real life, because you believe that this person is crazy and you believe that this person is out of control and might do something insane because you associate it with what Mel Gibson later turned out to, you know, reveal a little bit publicly, whether through what his, you know, girlfriend released some tapes of him saying some racist things or the famous anti-Semitism he espoused when he was stopped in traffic. And that, oddly enough, adds to the movie in Ransom, because you're like, oh, he might actually lose it and do something absolutely crazy. So the fact that he's making these threats and going along with it is, you know, a boon to the film in a weird way. But as I said about the extended cut of the 1996 version, it's so much helped because it explains so much. There's another scene very late in the film after Gary Sinise has, you know, he's faked the whole thing where he gets shot by Lily Taylor and he's in the hospital and Dario Lindo comes to visit him and is staring at him while he's, you know, reminiscing with some cops like, oh, I guess I just lucked out. Oh, I guess I get the money, all this other stuff. And we can't get these close-ups on Dario Lindo, who clearly does not believe him. And Gary Sinise is picking up on that, which explains why he goes to Mel Gibson early to go to get his check, because he knows the gig is up and that the jig is up and he is going to, they're going to figure out the, you know, the silliness here, and that they're going to call into question why he was there at that time, all the, you know, obviously loose ends. And so he can get out and go to Mexico. So all of this stuff's not, again, not in the theatrical cut. And it's really, really helps the movie because it's just explaining all these little details. And I really don't understand why it's not on DVD or Blu-ray. I understand why they had to cut the running time down for a theatrical cut to get it to 2 hours, but really the extra 20 minutes really help it. And there's even like stuff in the extended cut where we see how much Rene Russo and Mel Gibson are struggling to re-relate to their child who has gone through all this trauma. Because there's a scene where like he's still scared and like he's watching cartoons and he just seems distant. And you're like, this family's just never going to get right. Like it's not an overnight thing. They're not healed just because the kid came back into their life. I realize I could go on and on and on. But
hey, Adam, that was amazing. You just went like 15 straight minutes almost on Ransom, going back and forth between the 56 and the 53 TV version and deleted scenes, extended cut. Hopefully next year is the 25th anniversary that they'll come out with a special edition Blu-ray, DVD.
Well, they already had a Blu-ray and they didn't even include most of these deleted scenes. You can only get a couple of minutes of them on there, not even all 20 minutes. It's kind of a shame. I don't think this movie has a big enough following. It didn't make as much of a cultural impact as it would, you know. It's not something that's thought of as like one of Ron Howard's big hits. I mean, it, you know, it was the year after Apollo 13, which there's a much bigger following for, and the year after, you know, Mel Gibson made Braveheart. So people more think of it that way. Yeah, I can't imagine that there'd be like a big push if there hasn't been already, because it's just not a, you know, a thing that anybody thinks about other than it's just kind of like TBS or TNT fodder.
That's true, you know, and not to mention you were speaking of Mel Gibson's fall from grace, mm-hmm. so to speak. So that definitely isn't helping.
Yeah, that would cut down, especially because he's playing the hero here. But yeah,
right. How old were you the first time you saw Ransom?
I was 18. I saw it in the theater.
As did I. We actually had that was like my freshman year in college, and sometimes they would have like special sneak previews before they even came out, and I remember they had that, and it was a big deal. Like there was definitely a buzz, and everybody was into it. And of course, you know what everybody on campus was saying for like.
Yeah, they were like, "Give me back my son," even though that's kind of a cornball line.
What would you say is the message of Ransom?
I'd say the message is the same as it is in the original, which is don't ever consult your wife when you're going to make a major life decision, because you don't want to have to answer for how foolish you are. Because
Did you?
according to the narrative, it'll work out in the end no matter what you do. They're both very highly patriarchal movies.
That's well said. Did you learn anything from Ransom?
No, I mean it's just a well-made genre movie. I mean, I there's you know. I can only be sarcastic. I think you asked me this question, and I'll talk out of school here and say I answered some of these questions, in an email before, and it's the subtext, especially in the extended cut, is the breaking the law is just fine if you can buy your way out of it. This is really just about like, do we sympathize with rich people and their problems? And no, I don't. But so there's that element of it which you just kind of have to ignore. I mean, really, it really only works sort of as like, is it working as a genre thriller? And it does. Even in the theatrical cut, it works sort of, point to point. And, it has a lot more. The action's well cut together. It's relatively thrilling. I just think that the extended cut is an amazing improvement over what is, initially kind of a flawed film.
Okay, so if you were to change anything, mostly what you're saying would be to go with the extended cut.
It's not, yeah, the extended cut is a massive improvement. It's also the ending is not great. Once they turn Mel Gibson into an action hero, it is kind of a mistake because he's trying, he's playing just a regular guy. You can't turn him into like now he's having a fist fight, and there's that regrettable sequence where he slides over a taxi, and then you just roll your eyes at that. I mean, it's really kind of unfortunate. The ending I thought was bad enough that years ago, after I saw the extended cut, I'm like, wow, this is really good, except for this ending that I literally created a fan cut that has never been released, but where I tried to improve the ending, first ending the film by just cutting out the part where he shoots Gary Sinise, and then thought I didn't really go far enough. And then what I did was I cut out the part where the entire ending. So when they go to the bank, and then the cops recognize Gary Sinise on the street, and then I cut to Mel Gibson looking around, and Gary Sinise has utterly disappeared, and then Mel Gibson disappears, and then I incorporated audio commentary with of Mel Gibson from his Apocalypto commentary talking about Guadalajara, which is what Gary Sinise talks about in the car where he wants to go, and I incorporated that with some footage from Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia into turning it into Gary Sinise realizing he's screwed and kidnapping Mel Gibson and taking him to Mexico, incorporating the beginning of the Mel Gibson movie Get the Gringo, which is about a bank robber who crashes into Mexico, and with Mel Gibson narrating at the beginning. So basically the idea was that Gary Sinise was scared, couldn't get the money, and kidnaps Mel Gibson and brings him to Mexico. Because even though that's a ludicrous ending, it's still better than the sliding over the cab and winning a fist fight with a cop when you have no experience.
Adam, you are just oozing talent, man. You are like just you are what the film industry should be. They need more
I need more
Adam
fan
Lippies
cuts
out there.
of Ransom. That's it.
Yeah, exactly. Doing that, and I really want to get into "Wait, wait, don't kill me" before we leave. But before we do that, what is your favorite quote from Ransom?
I had two. There's a Delroy Lindo line that I like very much. So he's on the phone with his wife, and this is after the botched ransom drop off, and he's whispering on the phone because he's in Mel Gibson's house, and he goes, "I am so glad we are not rich." And then right in the background, Mel Gibson kind of gives him a look, and I think that's the funniest line in the whole movie. And there's another funny line by Evan Handler after Donnie Wahlberg is killed, who's playing Liev Schreiber's brother, and Liev Schreiber wants to go to the funeral, and Gary Sinise it wants to alert his mom, and Gary Sinise won't let him. And Evan Handler tries to sort of backhandedly console him, and he says, "You weren't going to be able to go to your brother's funeral anyway." And that also made me laugh very much.
Yeah, that's a classic line. All right, well, Adam, I don't think there's any denying that you are not only a Ransom super fan, I think you are the Ransom super
Oh, I would think that Ron Howard probably likes it more than
fan.
me.
Possibly. Well, Adam, can we Do you mind talking about Wait, Wait,
Of
Don't Tell
course,
Me
that's
real quick?
fine.
Just let everybody know, what's it
Okay,
about?
sure.
Where can
So
they see it?
it takes place in inner city Philadelphia on the hottest day of the year, and there's a virus that gets loose in inner city Philadelphia in a place called Nicetown, which is a real place in Philadelphia. And because it takes place on the hottest day of the year, and the virus causes massive dehydration, people start attacking each other for their bodily fluids, and one of the attacks is caught on a viral video. And the military comes into a local hospital to try to stop the spread of the virus, and they realize they can't do it quickly enough. So they fence off the inner city and let everybody die. And it's about people who are left there to die, which I know sounds very grim, but it's actually like more comedic than you'd think. And obviously, it's very prescient. I didn't shoot it this week or in the last 5 months. It was finished in March, and then it just got distributed in August. It's currently playing at the Lemley Theaters, but by the time you hear this, it may not be playing there anymore. It'll be playing somewhere else. So go to waitwaitdontkillme.com to figure out where it's playing then, because it'll always be updated. So yes, it's a viral pandemic movie. It is about the fact that the government doesn't care that the virus is loose in the inner city because they know that no one will care that the victims are poor, black, and brown. And yeah, again, I did not make this in the last 3 months. This was made a while ago.
Wow. yeah, I think everybody's going to want to see that. So definitely go check that out. Remember, Wait, Wait, Don't Kill Me. Go to the website, see where it's playing, and check that out. Adam, thank you so much for joining us. This has been amazing. You are just your intelligence and everything you spoke of is just off the charts. Incredible.
Well, I got a lot
Best of
more,
luck.
so whatever you want.
Yeah. Oh yeah. This movie battle, I can't wait. So we'll talk to you real soon,
Okay.
okay? All right, thanks. Welcome back to Movie Battle. Our next guest is making Movie Battle history. With his third appearance, we welcome back the great Neil Woodliffe. Neil, originally from Creedmoor, North Carolina, went to UNC Chapel Hill. He currently works for North Carolina Farm Bureau Insurance and lives in Raleigh, North Carolina, with his girlfriend Mandy and their celebrity dog Benny, that you can follow on Instagram. Neil is an avid Baltimore Orioles fan who enjoys Chaps pit beef and a roast grill hot dog every now and then. Neil, welcome back to Movie Battle.
Thank you, Kevin. It's a privilege. It's an honor. My third appearance here. I appreciate you
Absolutely.
coming
Yeah,
back
and
to me.
just to review for the some of our newcomers here, we're still going with Jason Alexander plays you in a movie about your life.
I don't think there's really anywhere else to go for that. Do you? I mean, I could there. It, you will never. You can do this podcast for 75 more years, and I don't think you'll ever get a more perfect match than that.
It's real and spectacular. Neil, refresh my memory. What is your go-to movie snack?
My go-to movie snack, traditionally it's been Junior Mints, in theaters. But since theaters have been closed down for, I don't know what, since March, 6 going on, or 7 months, going on 8 months, I have kind of moved to a new movie snack. The at-home movie snack, late at night watching a movie, has become Rainbow Sherbet.
I did not see that coming.
Didn't? Yeah, I know. It's non-traditional, but
Oh
it's
man,
non-traditional
when
times.
I say that you were going to make podcast history, you made podcast history. All right, well, let's get down to business, Neil. You are a Taken super fan. What is it you love so much about the film?
I mean, Taken has become, part of, really part of the popular culture in, in America especially. And it's one of those movies, it didn't win any awards. I don't think it was nominated for any awards, but I would say 75, 85% of the people you walk up on the street will know this movie just by saying a few of the lines from it. It kind of pushed Liam Neeson into the, a little more into the mainstream spotlight. It's a movie. It's got action. It's got the alpha male, lead that was kind of that was made. It kind of a comeback. It kind of re-energized that type of movie. Just action movie with just kind of a tough, bad man as the main lead who's doing things for, to for his family, and I love it. It's just, you know, it's just one of those movies that's fun to watch. I mean, when it's on at, you know, 1 a.m. on TBS, and you flip it through.
That's a good point. You know, we've had since then The Equalizer and then the John Wick films.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You've had all those. I mean, you know, it kind of goes back to, you know, I think about it, kind of re-energized that type of movie. You know, you had like the, you know, the cop movies with Eastwood and the other kind of alpha male movies with Bronson back in, you know, the '70s, you know, with Death Wish and some of those movies, The Mechanic, and then, you know, Eastwood's Dirty Harry movies. But then it was kind of seemed like a lull through, you know, for a period of time, maybe through the '90s. I can't really point to any movies that went on there. I'm sure there are plenty, but this one just kind of had that good resurgence with, you know, great casting for it. And it's just one of those movies that I've not talked to many people who did not like this movie or did not enjoy it when they saw it. You know, even folks who aren't, you know, the action type movie connoisseurs, like, yeah, it was pretty good. It's pretty good. So I think that's what makes a movie. Yeah, and it makes me like, yeah, I love to watch it whenever it's on. You know, just kind of leave it on in the background or sit down and watch it again. Or,
it's a special film. How old were you the first time you saw Taken?
Came out, I think, in 2008, which I actually thought I was a little older than that, to be honest with you. So that would have put me at about, 75, 33 years old. So I was well established into my adulthood, so I could appreciate it, you know, take it all in.
What would you say is the message of Taken?
You know, I thought about this, and it's the message that I see in it is probably going to be surprising. One, it's listen to your parents, children. You know, dad knew what he was talking about. You know, don't go to a foreign country, you know, unattended and carefree. You know, bad things can happen. You know, I kind of took it as like, well, it's a good lesson movie. And it also is a movie that shows what a parent will, the lengths a parent will go to for their child. You know, it's that's kind of two things I took from it. That's kind of digging deep down in it. But, you know, I think that's some teachable moments in this movie outside of the, you know, straight up action and you know, toughness and all that stuff. I think you can pull some good stuff out of it to kind of teach people with.
Was there anything you didn't understand or anything you would change about Taken?
No, the movie's straightforward. It's what it is. You know, it's a very simple, basic plot. You know, you didn't have some twist or some turn or anything like that or anything really hidden in it. You know, anybody who made some sort of heel turn throughout the movie you thought was a hero. You know, one thing, yeah, I might would change, and this is just something I've heard through the years that, you know, maybe they should have picked a fictional country in Eastern Europe to call, you know, to kind of promote as being a heavy sex trafficking, human trafficking country, because my understanding is Albania, you know, was the country that the movie centered on, that the kid was taken to, and the organized crime was being run out of for the human trafficking, and it kind of got a bad name and a little drop to the point that they actually had Liam Neeson do some promos for him in some advertising.
I was about to say, I bet that would affect tourism. Wow.
Yeah, so I was kind of like, you know, looking back, maybe, you know, maybe just being a little more gentle with that, not thinking about the ramifications. You know, maybe just, you know, come up with some funky name with Stan at the end of it that's fictional, and nobody ever would have known the difference because it's, you know, like 400 Stan.
A fictional country ending in Stan. Has that ever been done before?
Maybe once or twice, maybe.
All right, so what would you say overall you liked best about Taken?
Taken, it's simple. You know, it's the action. It's Brian Mills. It's his character. You know, it's that tough alpha male that's going to, you know, go to any length he can, you know, especially in this case for his family, for his daughter. You know, it was just that type of movie with that type of character. And it really allows you to just sit back and enjoy it because You know, you see what he's doing. You see him mulling through all the levels, going through what he needs to go through to get to, you know, his end game, his goal of, you know, saving his daughter, keeping her safe, you know, make sure nothing bad happens to her. You know, that's what makes this movie so good. You know, some movies are deep. Some movies have layers. You know, some movies have, you know, all sorts of plot twists, you know, tons of character development. You know, this movie isn't truly one of those cerebral type films, but it does allow you to see each piece, each step. You get a little bit of background on the characters, especially Mills' character, you know, with the background with his ex-wife, you know, the mom, the rich stepdad, you know, who kind of has pushed him aside because he's, you know, spoiled the daughter and that sort of thing. And you can just sit back and enjoy it after you get that just enough. You know, it's just enough salt to give it flavor. And then you sit back and enjoy it. You know, it's just that, you know, that simple idea of a film that makes it so enjoyable and one that you want to rewatch, you know, over and over again.
Very well said, Neil. Before we get out of here, what is your favorite quote from Taken?
From Taken. So, you know, everybody, you know, the quote that everybody knows is, you know, it's a long, you know, almost like monologue from Brian Mills, from Liam Neeson's character, you know, where his daughter's going to be taken. And, you know, he says, I have a particular set of skills I've acquired over a period of time. And he said, you know, I will find you, I will kill you. Everybody knows that quote. But in watching the movie a couple times, you know, preparing for this, what stood out to me is when they were talking about she was going to Europe and they said, well, you just don't need to worry. And he said, well, this is the quote that I like from the movie. He said, that's like asking water not to be wet.
Classic.
And I was like, you know, I like that. You know, it's, I like that. I do. So
that's excellent.
That's my all quote.
Right. Well, Neil, your third appearance, has not been a disappointment. Always, you always come correct.
I try.
All right. We'll talk to you soon. Best of luck in the movie battle.
No problem. Thanks, Kev.
All right, party people. It's the moment you've been waiting for. Time for the movie battle. Up first, representing Ransom, Adam Lippe. Adam, talk to me.
So, as I said earlier, I think Ransom in the theatrical cut is okay, and I think it's an exceptional film in the extended Laserdisc cut. And part of the advantage you have when you're watching something at home is you have a lot more breathing room, so that's why this 2 hour and 20 minute cut works so much better. And you get so much more time with the villains versus, say, the original 1956 version. And because you're using these actors who generally wouldn't be used in villain roles. You wouldn't have Gary Sinise, at least at this time, or Lily Taylor, or Evan Handler, or Liev Schreiber in villain roles. They've played, they're more soft presences. And it really helps in terms of your empathy, because to be honest, the villain roles aren't as filled out as much as they can be. Their motivations are other than financial are a bit nebulous. But because you have this side of it, you can kind of understanding, and the extended cut really shows you the mirror between what they're going through and what the parents are going through, and how they're both kind of questioning it, which differentiates it from just a fairly standard abduction kidnapping thriller, which might be more meat and potatoes. And since the movie kind of, since Ransom and the extended cut really gives you, you know, almost four full acts of a film, which is unusual, because once they get the child back, there's a whole nother act where we see what Gary Sinise, you know, watching his mind move and try to figure out, oh, okay, you know, how quickly should he ask for the money, and how is the family going to recover? And because of this earlier threat in the film where Delroy Lindo has implied that he hasn't turned Mel Gibson in, even though he knows that he bribed Dan Hedaya, that he might turn him in at any moment. And you don't know whether, you know, he says basically, you know, I'm not a, you know, this is not a protected conversation. So you know, he's not a lawyer and he's not a therapist, and you never know. Does that mean as soon as the movie's over, is either Mel Gibson going to be arrested for the bribery thing, by the FBI? Is he going to be, you know, charged with something for the shooting? Will he be charged with something for breaking that news van's window? There's all this kind of the characters don't really recover, which is different for one of these movies in which the movie ends and then you don't think about it ever again. And there's like kind of a haunting element to the film that could have been scuttered like completely if you know, if it was just more boilerplate, if it hadn't, you know, it's, as I said earlier, it's written by Richard Price, who gives a little bit more thought to these sorts of things, like he did in The Wire and Clockers, in sort of the crime genre. And that's one of the things that I rather appreciate, is that you get both sides. In the 1956 version, there's nothing on the villains at all. It's all black and white. There's, you know, the only interesting thing about the original 56 version is Leslie Nielsen's first movie, and he plays the slimy reporter, which doesn't get as much attention as in the remake. And the only reason the press even enters the remake is an interesting thing where basically Mel Gibson's trying to be such a strong man that he won't have the double do the drop off. And so that's why the press picks up that this kid has been kidnapped. If the double did the drop off, they never would have figured it out at all. And maybe the whole conceit of the film doesn't come up, but because Mel Gibson is so proud and he's got to do this himself, and he figures that it's important for him, that the fact the double doesn't do it, and they recognize Mel Gibson. That's what sets off the entire plot. And so you have that, you know, that famous scene where he's, you know, doing the thing in front of the news and saying this is as close as you'll ever get, which is an interesting manipulative gambit. And I think, as I said earlier, aided by the fact that we have all this time after the movie has come out where Mel Gibson has shown himself to be of a particular type, to where you think he might do something that doesn't seem all that well thought out and perhaps insane. And I'm aware that Mel Gibson apparently did add a couple of sequences to the film because he wanted, you know, the rigmarole that he has to go through to get to the first, the thing where he jumps in the water to get the key at the bottom and then change the money and all that other stuff. That was sort of added, and that sort of Rube Goldberg element is kind of different for a film like that, which again, as I said, like differentiates itself from the more meat and potato stuff that it could have been. And again, we have like more like backstory. That's really helpful because in the extended cut, you really find out about Rene Russo, but you also get some of the more lives of the cops, and that's a little bit better. I don't like to repeat myself, and I also don't want to talk over too much. But one of the other things that I really like is there's this moment that does echo Lethal Weapon a little bit, where it looks like after Mel Gibson has screwed up, where he's screaming at Gary Sinise and he thinks his son is dead, he's about to kill himself. And that's not the kind of thing that would normally be in a mainstream, you know, big budget movie like this, where you think the hero is about to kill himself, and you actually believe that he might, and it would be palatable. Of course, you know, this is still a big budget movie, so we're going to have somewhat of a happy ending, even if it's a bit more open-ended than would normally happen. One of the reasons I mentioned the deleted scenes is because it adds so much darkness, and so it aids that sort of thought, oh, maybe he will kill himself. Like, it, you know, because you think, oh, he is a criminal, he thinks he might go to jail, and his son is dead, and what's he have left to live for? All that sort of stuff. But I want to give you your time, Neil, because I could probably talk about this forever.
I mean, it's movies like this, you know, you can there, you know, and to talk about, you know, we'll talk a little bit towards the end, but, you know, Ransom is a great, great movie. You know, I'm a Taken guy simply because, you know, as I was telling Kevin in the intro part, you know, Taken is a very simple movie, a simple plot, simple story. It's straightforward. It doesn't have the layers that a lot of movies do. Probably not the layers that Ransom has, as far as, you know, developing things. I mean, it's straightforward. You know, kid goes to Europe. Dad tells kid not to go to Europe. He's worried about her. Kid is apparently a spoiled brat with spoiled brat friends. Doesn't listen. Lies to dad. Gets to Europe. Bad things happen. You know, dad has to fix it. You know, it's a very simple plot story, but a very entertaining one, and one that, you know, why I'm such a fan of the movie, it's just an enjoyable movie to watch. You know, people who don't enjoy these types of movies oftentimes will sit and watch Taken and say, yeah, that was a pretty good movie. Yeah, the characters in the movie that in Taken, you know, I think the Ransom cast has a little bit more, you know, long-term star power than Taken does when you look at who's in the cast. I think Ransom was out in 96, I believe, and, you know, Taken was 2008, and of course, you know, Liam Neeson you know, is Brian Mills. That's become an iconic character, you know, an iconic role, a pop culture type character that's been parodied, it's been mimicked, it's been used in commercials. You know, even some of the lines from the movie, his famous, you know, little monologue about having skills. You know, it's become part of today's society, really. You know, just everybody knows it. Famke Johnson, you know, she plays, you know, the typical ex-wife who, you know, left her husband because he gave too much to his country and not enough to her, and now has evidently a, you know, filthy, just atrociously rich new husband who obviously spoils the daughter based on the pony that he gives her after, you know, dad gives her the little karaoke machine because she wants to be a singer, which the thought behind that gift is way better and way deeper than, you know, the rich guy giving her a pony. You know, and after that, you know, not many other stars in the movie. You've got a young Maggie Grace plays his daughter. She went on to a few things. And you've got the her friend who's kind of the troublemaker in this, young Katie Cassidy, who went on to be in the remake of 90210 or Melrose Place. And then, of course, in the Arrow series. But, you know, they provided the roles they needed to provide in these movies. So not a lot of star power, but it was a good cast to me for what the movie was. You know, after that, not even a lot of, as Kevin calls them, that guys in this movie. You know, most of them, you got some, I think, some European actors and that sort of thing. But yeah, the movie is just one that, you know, it's majority of it's set in Europe. You know, it's a lot of light and dark in the movie that I saw. You know, most of the movie, I think it happened over the course of like 2 days because it was a 96-hour window to get her back. They made a big deal about that. You know, a lot of stuff happens in the dark. She's returned, everybody's safe, and she's getting her voice lesson with the little pop star that her dad helped kind of save from the attack at the beginning of the movie. You know, so those are the things about the movie that I think makes it a great movie. Is it a technical textbook masterpiece of a movie? No, it's not. But it's a movie that I think everybody likes to watch. Everybody wants to watch when it's on, and they enjoy it. You know, and to me, that's why the movie is so much fun to watch. You know, it's not a true blue popcorn movie like they call them, you know, where it's completely mindless and you sit back, but you can just enjoy it for what it is. You know, a tough guy, you know, mowing through everybody to get his daughter back at all costs. And, you know, you get some laughs in it. You get some, you know, some poignant moments. You get, you know, a few surprises, you know, finding the friend dead in the little makeshift brothel and, you know, that sort of thing. Finding out his bud there, who's the cop in Albania, is, you know, kind of on the take or getting paid. And that took me actually something, the first time I saw it, ever saw it, in the scene where he goes and pumps him for information and he wasn't given and he shoots his wife. That surprised me. I thought, oh my God, he just shot his wife for no reason until, you know, after watching two on video, I realized, oh no, he realized he was kind of on the take. And not saying the lady didn't deserve to be shot, but, you know, it's collateral damage. This is all the things I like about the movie. It's just a fun movie. Good movie to watch.
Well said, Neil.
Characters are good.
Adam, we were talking earlier, Neil and I, about just that whole kind of the revenge action genre, how the 70s and 80s you had all the Charles Bronson films, and then they just kind of went away for a while. But then you have movies like Ransom, and then, I mean, a dozen years later, Taken, and then now we've got The Equalizer.
Sure, Taken is a bit more of a throwback to the Bronson stuff because it's kind of, you know, mindless exploitation, xenophobic stuff that the Bronson movies kind of specialized in.
Yeah, and I think Taken kind of gave a little bit of a re-energization to that kind of brand of movie after a while. You know, I was, I'm not quite sure how old you are. I'm 45, so I grew up and, you know, going to the old video store in Creedmoor and picking out the movies, you had these sections, you know, for like action, and you would always see the Eastwood movies, you know, the Dirty Harry line of movies, then the Bronson movies, you know, Mr. Majestic and The Mechanic and The Death Wishes and all those. And you know, it was always kind of a, you know, I guess maybe bad parenting. My parents like, oh yeah, watch it, that's fine.
And your parents let you watch Kinjite Forbidden Subjects with Bronson. That's kind of a nasty movie, if you know that one.
Yeah, I mean, But it kind of like that kind of like rough, you know, alpha male, you know, revenge, you know, type movie kind of went away a little bit, I think, through the 90s as a whole. And when this came back, it was so popular, I think, really and truly because of some of the lines in it. I mean, everybody knows the lines, you know, I have a particular set of skills, and then, you know, I will find you, I will kill you. I mean, how many times has that been used, you know, in conversations with buddies and you know, memes and all sorts of TV shows? I mean, it's just kind of came to the, you know, that's really what brought this movie more to light. And, you know, I'll be the first one to admit, I won't discuss, you know, too much of Taken 2 and Taken 3 at that point. You know, Taken is the movie, and to me should be left alone, like Caddyshack should have been left alone, and no Caddyshack 2 or no Roadhouse 2 if you are unfortunate enough to have ever seen.
But outside of that 30 seconds that you have that's in the trailer for Taken, there's not a lot of meat on the bone. I mean, that's really like the highlight. They put it in the trailer. It's clearly the best moment in the movie. Mm-hmm. And the rest of it kind of fits into that Luc Besson model of how quickly can we get to France and how dumb are the cops going to be?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It becomes a movie that you just watch and enjoy because you know what's going to happen for the most part. You know, there are no big surprises. I told Kevin earlier, it's a movie where there's no twist, there's no big reveal, there's no turn, there's no, well, that came out of right field. You know, it is what it is. You know, the thing that you're looking at is like, well, how many people, you know, or how many people was he going to take out to get there? And, you know, although not likely, it was a slim chance, you know, something could have happened to the daughter, especially when you find her friend dead in the brothel. You know, you wonder, it's like, oh, you know, something going to happen, you know, to her. But, you know, it's just one of those movies where, you know, I always talk about movies as, you know, you've got the movies that are really good. You know, they have the true artistic value. They have, you know, I used to term them layers. You know, they go through a ton of character development. And then you have the movies that are good, but I call them more rewatchable movies. I'm not saying Ransom isn't, because you know, I've seen that movie several times. It's been a while since I saw it, but I've seen a movie, so a great movie. But, you know, I think as far as the general public goes and what's kind of out there as more recognizable with people now is Taken. And it's for what you just said. You know, it had that pop to it that stuck more so. You know, I don't want to call it a one-hit wonder, but, you know, it's kind of that's what everybody knows, and everybody knows the movie. Doesn't mean a movie's any better or worse than another. It just means it's more recognizable and more people are apt to just say, hey, I like that movie. You know,
I remember when Taken came out and Luc Besson was talking about how he'd written the movie over the weekend. And I thought to myself, what did he do on Saturday and Sunday? It's you know, if you know Luc Besson's style, like if you'd seen like the Taxi movies, like the first three Taxi movies before the remake, and, you know, Kiss of the Dragon and all the Americanized films that he put, this is like so much like assembly line stuff that at the time when it came out, I was like, eh, this is all right. And then when I watched it over the weekend, I'm like, wow, this is they got nothing to hang on this. I guess it's something I don't quite get other than the sense of like, what if you put Liam Neeson in one of these schlocky movies? Because there's not a lot of, I didn't find there was a lot of energy in the action sequences. They're very repetitive and very kind of samey. Like there's that car chase where he's going against traffic, and you always think about something like To Live and Die in L.A., the William Peterson Friedkin movie with the same sequence. And they're using like projection behind Liam Neeson throughout the sequence. Like there's no energy to it at all. And like the whole, like, yeah, I was kind of saddened by, like, I thought this would, you know, have more than like, than just the premise. And then, you know, the first 20 minutes are like, how are those great character actors, John Grease and Leland Orser, going to show up and they're going to do something. And it just turns out they're just doing exposition dumps and leaving the movie. Same with Xander Berkeley. You're like, oh, great, a character actor who I can and then it's just, nope, he's just, you know, he's just a, you know, basically a placard to stand there and go, I lend credibility to this. I was actually kind of frustrated that it didn't, like, it did not hold my attention at all. I was kind of surprised. But sorry, you go ahead, Neil. You were defending it. I'm sorry.
That's, you know, and I think that's the difference. You know, you've got that kind of movie that you come in with that expectation of, and then you've got the other movies where you want to get more out of it from a cerebral sense. You know, Taken is not a movie, you know, that is going to ever be accused of, you know, breaking any sort of theatrical boundaries as far as being cutting edge or anything like that. It's just a fun movie, you know, for most people to sit around and watch and have on, you know, with the story. You know, as far as some of the character development, you know, Brian Mills is, you know, he's a CIA operative, former Green Beret. It's talked about in the movies. He's got his buddies there. You know, he's got the ex-wife. You can tell he's obviously, you know, just he's removed from his family so much now, especially with the family situation the daughter has with the filthy rich stepdad. And, you know, you kind of see that sadness a little bit if you start trying to pull things out of it. And that's his life. That's why he does what he does. You know, one thing that I told Kevin, not always, but I noticed when I watched it again, is being older now watching it. I don't have kids, but you know, being older now watching it, I said, you know, I kind of get from the movie is, you know, you can sell it to folks like, well, you know, kids, listen to your parents. Dad was right. And, you know, parents will do anything to save their, you know, kids and protect them. And, you know, it also gave me a little sense of, you know, oh, you know, little snot-nosed brat friend, you know, she kind of, it sounds harsh and could get Kevin's podcast tagged, but she kind of got what she deserved, you know, being that hard-headed about things, you know, not really, but that's.
I mean, that's the Luc Besson special, though. Like, he likes to have these super skinny women who look like little girls. That's in all of his movies because they all look like his ex-wives, like Mia Jovovich and some other women. And they're always put in sexual positions where you're like, you know, where he plays with the idea of, are you attracted to this? And is this woman, this little girl, going to be tortured? And isn't there a sexual thrill to this? It's kind of distasteful in a way because he keeps going back to it over and over. He's been doing it since like the Femme Nikita. So there's always that queasiness, and especially like with him framing it in the, like, he always has the swarthy villains who are vaguely Algerian, vaguely Eurotrash, vaguely Algerian. He just kind of keeps going back to the same well over and over. That's what I noticed this time. I'm like, I mean, he's got the one note and he's just playing it over and over and over. But Liam Neeson, I guess, excels, you know, at least I think he's above the fray in a weird way. I haven't seen the sequels, so I'm assuming that those are worse.
The sequels are not as entertaining as the first two by any means. You know, if you find the first one a little bit vanilla and a little bit you know, stale, then the next two are not going to do anything for you at all. I think and spoiler alert for those listening in podcast world who may actually watch the sequels, you know, in the third one they finally kill off Liam Neeson's wife. She's the victim early on in the movie, and he hunts down, you know, who the killer is, and it ends up being, you know, the brother of the Marco, the kidnapper in this movie.
I hope it's a twin. So, is it like a Legend of Curly's Gold? It's really the twin. Is it the same actor? I hope so.
No, unfortunately, I don't think it was, but. Yeah, that's pretty good. I like that. Kevin, there's some movies for your next podcast, right?
Yeah, dude, go. Yeah. Look Who's Talking to versus City Slickers 2.
I'm telling you, if he really wants to take a podcast and go about as low as you go for people who, if you can find two human beings who are super fans of the movies, go Caddyshack 2 versus Roadhouse 2, and that would be a legendary effort to find that.
I may be able to set that up for you, but not in the way that you think. When we're off the air, I'll explain why.
Yeah. All right. Yeah, that's but yeah, Taken's my go-to. It's one of my movies. It's on when it's on, I'll usually leave it on in the background and you know, sit there and enjoy it for, you know, what it is. It doesn't require me to have to, you know, bend my mind a whole lot, but I just enjoy watching it and just the simple, you know, just kind of the simple, I know we can try and keep it PG on Kevin's podcast, but the simple badass nature of the lead in it. You know, like I said, it harkens me back to Eastwood and Bronson, and even some of the, you know, Chuck Norris film. I always like Lone Wolf McQuade. And I think about just this kind of, you know, it's just that type of character that makes it enjoyable no matter what setting it is.
Question for you, Neil, then. Do you wish, because I do, because I like some of the silliness of the Bosson films, specifically Transporter 2, which is a remarkably stupid movie, but a lot of fun. Do you wish that Taken was either that silly and over the top or a little bit more realistic? Or do you like the kind of sort of middle of the road, like a little bit more generic in the action sequences that, that it does present?
You're right. It's a little more middle of the road. And I think I like it for that reason, because it didn't commit to just complete over the top. You know, I've seen Transporter 2. That complete over the top type presentation, you know, versus going in the other direction of making it, you know, really
like it could be nastier. More. I mean, and it's not that either. It kind of backs off being nasty.
Yeah, no.
And they kind of throw away the ending by just him having shoot the guy who looks like Jabba the Hutt, and then the movie's over.
Oh yeah, yeah, that was, you know, in which that was kind of the very end of the movie was kind of surprising as far as that goes. A little bit, you know, he's got her and you're wondering like, well, you know, what's going to happen? Is he going to do this? And he just pulls trigger and you're like, oh, well, there's that. So that's didn't really thought it might be a little bit more there, but you know, but I think that's what makes it for me, you know, my personal taste.
Come on, stand by your movie with some passion. Come on, let's go.
So I do. I love the movie. It's a fun movie. You don't have to overthink it. And that's sometimes what you know, kind of what you want on occasion. And as far as that type of movie goes, that's kind of what I like. You know, Ransom, great movie. You know, can't say anything negative.
Well, then
about
I recommend watch those deleted scenes on YouTube, and if you can track down the extended cut, it's an immensely improved movie by that.
Yeah, hearing you talk about that, it's kind of interesting. I wonder what exactly
the deleted scenes, but even as when you incorporate them into the movie, they're like it's much better because it's all this character stuff that explains virtually every decision that seems kind of mysterious in the theatrical cut, and it's like, oh, all right, I get it, okay. And there's much more symmetry between the villains and the heroes.
It was a great cast, you know, great cast in that movie.
Well, Adam, Neil, this discussion has been just amazing. Just the amount of information here is just out of this world. Y'all are just dropping knowledge on us, and we thank you. Before we get out of here, I'd like for each of you to just kind of give your final word on your movie. Adam, Ransom?
So if you can track down the extended cut, whatever means you have to use in order to do it, it's worth it. If you have to buy a Laserdisc player and get the Laserdisc, unfortunately, as I said earlier, the Blu-ray and the DVD do not have all the deleted scenes on it for some odd reason. Only a couple minutes of the about 20 that you can find on YouTube right now. Don't think they're going to pull it off YouTube because this is not as popular a movie with as much longevity as I think it would have if you had the extended cut available. I like some of the nastiness of Ransom. I didn't mention that before. I like some of the mean-spiritedness of it. I think that helps the movie. I think also as well as the messiness of having Mel Gibson truly be kind of a villain. I think that's aided by his real-life troubles. And I like a lot of the character stuff. The action works fairly well, and as is the big scene that they give away in the trailer that where Mel Gibson is, you know, putting Ransom on people's heads. I think that works much better than it did in the 1956 version. I think that this, you know, even if you're just going to watch the theatrical cut again, it's the theatrical cut is a B-minus movie. And I think the extended cut is closer to an A-minus movie, a 4 out of 5 stars versus a 2.5 star movie, I think.
Awesome. Neil, Taken?
Taken. Look, if you want a movie that you can sit down on a Thursday night with a quart of rainbow sherbet and enjoy it and just watch a movie, get some action, get some great lines, some great quotes that have stood the test of time, become part of, you know, popular American culture, see some, you know, just a guy come in, tear everybody up, save his daughter, teach a lesson to her about listening to dad, and, you know, always knowing that he's going to be there for you. This is the movie for you. Just sit back, enjoy it. Enjoy the fight scenes, enjoy the ending, you know, just sit back and enjoy it. And that's really the reason that this movie is one that everybody should watch and enjoy at some point in their life.
Well said. And I hope you enjoy that rainbow sherbet.
Yes, sir.
Are you eating that like out of, is it like the clear tub with the handle on it?
Not with the handle. I get the quart sizes that they have at our local food line. So it's good for two sittings. Good for two sittings.
Okay. All right. Well, Adam, Neil, I appreciate both of y'all being on here. This has been a great episode. Before we get out of here, Adam, why don't you talk about
Wait? Sure. So it's a viral pandemic movie about a virus in the inner city. You probably heard me talk about it earlier if you made it this far. So it takes place in inner city Philadelphia on the hottest day of the year. And this disease starts to affect all those people, and government comes in, tries to stop it, slow it down, realize they can't do it. So they fence off the inner city, and everyone begins to die. And it's about the people who are left there to die. So you go to waitwaitwaitdontkillme.com, and you'll see where it's playing as of, since I don't know when this recording is going to be released, at the moment it's playing via virtual streaming. The Lemley Theaters in Los Angeles, though you don't have to live in Los Angeles, you can just go to lemley.com and look up Wait, Wait, Don't Kill Me, and it's playing there. When that run is over, it'll be playing somewhere else. As long as you go to waitwaitdontkillme.com, you'll find it. And you can find the trailer and then TV spots and all sorts of things and other interviews I've done, you know, ad nauseum, if you go there. And that's pretty much it.
All right. Well, we'll definitely have to check that out. Mm-hmm. Adam, thanks again. This has been awesome. Neil, you're always welcome here.
Thank you.
And this has been awesome. Thank you very much, guys.
Cool.
Thank you, everybody, for listening to Movie Battle and for your continued support. I would like to give extra thanks to our guests, Adam Lippe and Neil Woodliff. As always, if you are feeling it, please recommend to a friend or leave a review, share on social media. You can find Movie Battle on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Thank you for coming correct.